is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. 2 years ago, President Trump nominated billionaire donor Betsy DeVos to be the head of the Department of Education.
If confirmed, I will be a strong advocate for great public schools. But if a school is troubled or unsafe or not a good fit for a child, we should support a parent's right to enroll their child in a high-quality alternative.
Now, Betsy DeVos's confirmation hearing took nearly 4 hours, which for a confirmation hearing, I should tell you, is very, very long. And then the Senate debate was contentious as well, with some Democrats so opposed to Betsy DeVos that they staged all-night speeches to come out against her.
In my mind, she is the least qualified nominee in a historically unqualified cabinet.
Democratic leader Chuck Schumer there. Well, in the end, the Senate split in a 50-50 tie on the floor, and Vice President Mike Pence had to break that tie and push Betsy DeVos over the line.
The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes in the affirmative, and the nomination is confirmed.
Mike Pence on the floor back in 2017, giving Betsy DeVos the nod to be Secretary of Education. But what has the department been up to since then? After the initial flurry of headlines, news from the department has been fairly quiet. And that doesn't mean that nothing's happened. Later in the hour, we'll hear from the now Democratic leader of the House Committee on Education and Labor. But first, a guest who definitely knows what's been happening in the Department of Education under the Trump administration. Jim Blue is the Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development at the U.S. Department of Education. Jim Blue, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate the opportunity.
Bring us up to speed. We're going to get to a whole bunch of issues in the short time we have, Jim. What exactly do you do there as the Secretary, Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development? What's your job?
Our office takes care of policy development here at the department, including the budget. We also are responsible for some of the research and evaluation activities.
And what specific policies have you had your hand in recently?
Well, last week, the secretary introduced a major proposal to expand school choice throughout the country.
Now, you say school choice, and I know that a lot of ears around the 1A radios and podcasts just perked up. That's a loaded term. Tell me what you mean, Jim Blue, when you say school choice.
Yeah. Thanks for asking the question, because a lot of people have a misimpression about our attitude towards school choice. What we mean when we talk about it is that families should have lots of high-quality options to choose among when they're selecting a school for their child. Unfortunately, in this country, many people don't have that opportunity. They are stuck in one school, and sometimes that school is not a good fit for their child.
Now, you put your finger on it, Jim. You said that school choice can be a loaded term, means different things to different people. And I know that there are a lot of people listening to this program right now who heard that term and say, that's another way to say vouchers. That's a euphemism for defunding public schools at the moment they need that funding the most.
No, not at all. And in fact, the proposal that the secretary announced this last week is a scholarship program that can be used both for public school options and for private school options, as well as homeschool, virtual school, virtually anything that a state decides. The program, I'm sorry, it's not actually a program. It is a tax credit that would encourage donations, voluntary donations to scholarship programs, and then states get to design how they would use those scholarships for their own students.
$5 billion in tax credits, as you said, for people and corporations to donate scholarship money for students to go to private schools if they choose. You get the tax write-off, which is the incentive built in to this
but
tax
Todd,
credit.
We have to be careful about how we say that, because if a state chose not to provide any private school options, scholarships would not be allowed for private school options.
So
it literally is up to the state. If they would like to use their scholarship funds for dual enrollment, career technical education, that's fine. We're not telling people how they have to design their scholarship programs. We're just trying to encourage more high-quality options out there across the country.
And opt-in, in other words, if states don't want to do it, they don't have to do it. A lot of the reporting around this, Jim Blue, has suggested that you designed it this way to sidestep the constantly riddled landscape, riddled with landmines around school vouchers, that it's not government money, it's not a program. You were just at pains to say that. It's just an opt-in program if people want to have a tax credit to divert private money to private schools, why they can do that. Is it true you've designed it this way to try to get around the old and very bloody politics around this?
There are lots of reasons that we've designed the program this way. One is to make sure that it's a completely voluntary program. So if no one wants to contribute to a scholarship, then there won't be any scholarships to give. As you know, mostly public education is funded through compulsory taxes. So this is fundamentally different than that. Also, because it is a tax credit, the federal government doesn't need to get involved with new mandates, new rules, new regulations. We leave the control of education to states and local districts.
Our discussion, Jim, has, as I predicted, perked up the ears of lots of 1A listeners. Linda writes, tax money should go to public schools. If you want to seek education elsewhere, pay for it. I don't want to spend my money to send your child to private school. And Scott writes that these tax credits are just a way to divert tax dollars from public schools to schools that don't have to follow the same rules or be open to all students. Now, I will say, Jim, you've pointed out that that's not what this program does, but you know that your critics in Congress and elsewhere say it's all fine to give people the opportunity to have tax credits for donations so that kids can go to private schools. But this is a backdoor into vouchers. I'm going to use another tired cliche. This is a camel's nose under the tent to eventually get to what Republicans have wanted for decades, which is public money going to private schools.
So, Todd, everyone has a fairly tired argument. So the people who've tweeted into you haven't really listened to the proposal. When they say that there's money being diverted away from public schools and public school teachers, it's simply not the case, right? This is based on voluntary contributions. When you raise the topic, well, please say, I'm so sorry, please say that again, your second part.
A backdoor, that this program is a backdoor to eventually get to controversial vouchers.
No, it is a indirect way to provide a huge amount of school choice, new educational opportunities across the country.
Jim, we talked about your boss at the top of this program. She was controversial. We all know that. Her history with education is controversial to a lot of people who follow education policy. Linda writes to us on Facebook, DeVos and her family have done great damage to schools in Michigan. For-profit schools should not get public funding. Jim, I realize I'm putting you on the spot, but people do want to talk about your boss. And we got this voicemail from one listener who wanted to talk about Betsy DeVos in particular.
This is Ben. I'm a proud public middle school teacher from Indianapolis, Indiana. And I think the biggest issue I've seen since Betsy DeVos has taken the helm of the Department of Education is just the demoralization of the profession. When the chief educator of a country, the chief educator, is not even an educator, doesn't have any public school experience, didn't send her students to public school, didn't go to public school herself, it creates a situation where teachers feel like she doesn't understand what we do for kids every day. We see her policies through that lens, everything she does. And I think that's a big problem when you have a teacher shortage and all kinds of other issues that are causing people not to want to go into education. Having the chief education officer, not be an educator is extremely demoralizing.
Jim Blue, I think you already know that many people in education, many teachers, many administrators do feel demoralized about your boss. I'm sure you feel differently, but a lot of people share Ben's attitude.
Yeah, what I'd hope people would recognize is she doesn't see herself as the chief education officer of the country. She's not a national superintendent of schools. She is here because she cares a great deal about educating all students, all ages of students across the country. And she will continue to do that. The critique that she, you know, hasn't been a public school teacher, that feels like a criteria to run a cabinet office is just seems misplaced. What I can tell you is that the reason folks are opposed to Betsy DeVos is because they are uncomfortable with expanding options and choice across the country. And in particular, you know, there are some very well-funded political organizations whose job it is to make sure that families are trapped in schools where their teachers continue to control and dominate. So there is a divide in this country over this issue. I get it. But I can tell you with years of working with the secretary, she is hardworking, she is smart, and she is completely dedicated to the interest of children.
Jim, I have to let you go, but there's a reality here. Democrats have taken over the House. We're going to be speaking with Chairman of the Education Committee, Bobby Scott, in just a few minutes on the program. They're dead set against this proposal. Is it dead in the water for now?
No. We realize and embrace that we won't get anything done on school choice unless we make it a bipartisan issue. We've made it very attractive for Democrats to come alongside us. And you have to recognize that school choice is hugely popular in this country,
all right,
in Democratic districts and Republican districts.
Jim Blue, Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation and Policy Development at the Department of Education. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, more on the Department of Education with two leading education reporters and the chairman, as I promised, later in the hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Welcome back to 1A. This is Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. Today, a spotlight on the Department of Education. What exactly has it been up to for the last 2 years now? How many educators see Secretary Betsy DeVos's proposals as positive, and how many of them have actually been implemented? Erica Green covers education policy for The New York Times. She's in studio with me. Erica, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Kregbaum is here as well. He covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed. Andrew, thanks for being here as well.
Great to be here.
Now, we'd love to hear from you, too. I know that many of you want to sound off on policies from the Department of Education, and I know that because of the way our messages from you are piling up, especially if you're a teacher. How have federal policies affected the way that you run your classroom? And if you're a student or a parent, what questions do you have about the Department of Education and what they are doing now? You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. You can email us 1A@WAMU.org. Erica, first of all, can I get your reactions to what Jim Blue had to say at the top of the hour? We focused mostly on the new initiative, Betsy DeVos's proposal for $5 billion in tax credits so that private people, private companies can donate private money for people to go to private schools.
I mean, my reaction is, you know, this is what it's very early. First of all, it was just announced last week. This is how it has, you know, been presented consistently to us as reporters. And, you know, the way it was pushed out and the way it was experienced by those who are, you know, on either side of the school choice debate, I think will carry through it will carry through Congress. It will determine whether or not this will grow legs. You know, it is a way that school choice is going to either, you know, sink or swim in the next 2 years. It's the only legislative initiative that I really see the secretary having thrown her weight behind. So it's something that she obviously really believes in and it's going to go to the mat for. So we'll see. I mean, Democrats say it's dead on arrival. They control the House. So, you know, it has a long way to go. But we have seen, you know, a last minute amendment make it through to the spending bill that no one saw coming. It happened in the middle of the night, and that was the Cruz Amendment that expanded 529 college savings plans to K-12 expenses to be used for homeschooling and other expenses. So, you know, Cruz, who will sponsor this legislation in the Senate, pointed to that as an example of, the fact that it could be done.
So, Andrew, I asked Jim Blue a version of this question. This seems like an approach designed to sidestep the old, unsuccessful, very contentious politics of school vouchers, to find another way to divert resources. I say divert and people won't like that either, but you know what I'm talking about. Get resources so that students can find a way outside of the public school system that so many conservatives seem to be opposed to.
It's a new wrinkle, obviously, in pursuing school choice. It's using tax credits instead of vouchers. But like Erica mentioned, this is going to be very hard to pass, maybe impossible with this Democratic House. So you might say this is as much a messaging bill as anything else. It's a way for DeVos and Republicans in Congress to show they're doing something on school choice for supporters who are really demanding that. But the chances of it happening are very low.
Well, obviously, if it's a messaging effort, people have gotten the message. Roger emails, competition and choice work everywhere in our society and the economy to ensure improvement and customer satisfaction. What's the argument for exempting public schools from this very natural law? And Roxy tweets, I pay taxes and send my kid to parochial school, so I'm paying twice. We're not millionaires. We're sacrificing for a different school experience. How about a tax credit for parents instead? Would this proposal work, Erica, in a way that would satisfy Roxy at all as a parent? Could she find a way? I guess if she's already paying for her kid, it wouldn't be worth it for her to have a tax credit for donating money for her own kid to go to a parochial school.
Well, I mean, but as it stands, that's not an option. However,
right.
I mean, it has to go through Congress, and who knows what could be amended. I've heard that argument as well. At the end of the day, you know, the tax credit is going to be for anyone who donates to any, you know, organization that is creating programs that are eligible. And so Roxy could, use money or donate for either other students to go to other programs or for her child to go to other eligible programs that are outside of the parochial school.
Well, let's get back to the secretary, to Betsy DeVos herself for one moment. I want to play you a clip from Betsy DeVos. She was here at CPAC in Washington, the Conservative Political Action Conference. This clip comes from last year, where Betsy DeVos spoke for herself.
There are tax credit scholarships, education savings accounts. There are virtual schools. There are blended learning schools opportunities. There are charter public schools. And there's probably some methodologies not even yet discovered. But those are all just mechanisms. I think the core issue is that we need to really embrace, as a country, education freedom. And that allows us to think more broadly about what education should be.
That was Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos talking to attendees at the CPAC conference last year. Erica, talk a little bit about Betsy DeVos's unique history with school choice. She has a long history as an advocate and an activist in Michigan. When she says academic freedom, what does she mean?
It is a fancy way of saying school choice. The messaging has changed since Betsy DeVos came into office. There has been coverage that, you know, the department has taken steps to eliminate really divisive terms like choice and private. And it's really a rebranding. Education freedom is truly just empowering families to take whatever money at their disposal to go to different kinds of schools.
I have to say, I understand rebranding. It doesn't seem to have moved the needle on this debate one little bit. I'm not sure that anybody has been turned on or turned off. I think everybody knows what they think about this stuff.
Absolutely, because the devil is in the details, right? We saw a tax credit that was presented as educational choice scholarships, and you saw most of the coverage was dominated by vouchers versus public.
Andrew, I want to talk about Title IX. It's an issue that we have heard a lot about, very controversial from Betsy DeVos. Now, Title IX is the law that governs how colleges and universities investigate and police sexual harassment, right. Correct? And gender discrimination. The Obama administration had rules laid down. Betsy DeVos has endeavored to change those rules. And here's Secretary DeVos talking to reporters in 2017 about this issue of Title IX.
There are men and women, boys and girls, who are survivors, and there are men and women, boys and girls, who are wrongfully accused. The notion that a school must diminish due process rights to better serve the victim only creates more victims. A better way is also being more precise in the definition of sexual misconduct. If everything is harassment, then nothing is.
Now, Andrew, as I mentioned, this is not a debate that was new to Betsy DeVos. There were rules that were laid down under the Obama administration, and she caused a lot of controversy. She was just making her statement right there in, I don't know if I want to say overturning, but modifying vastly the rules on gender discrimination, sexual harassment at schools that receive public funding. Give me a sense of where the DeVos Education Department is on this issue right now and how policies look like they might change.
Sure. So Title IX is actually a very expansive rule. It addresses expansive law. It addresses gender discrimination issues broadly in K-12 and higher education. Initially, it was relevant to women's access to athletics, for example. But under the Obama administration, sexual misconduct on college campuses became a really big issue, partly because of the work of advocates and activists across the country. Now, the Obama administration issued two separate pieces of guidance instructing colleges how they should handle and investigate misconduct claims. And what the secretary has done is actually pull that guidance and said she's going to write her own federal regulation addressing the issue. So she issued that rule last year. It's just gone through a public comment process. There was a lot of interest in the rule, as evidenced by the over 100,000 comments received by the department. So now we're waiting for the department to take that feedback from the public into account and reshape their proposed rule accordingly. And we're expecting sometime this year to receive a final Title IX rule.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Erica, Betsy DeVos said that the department needs to be more precise in the definition of sexual assault on campus. What change does she want to make to the definition of sexual assault? What's she talking about there?
What the department has proposed to do is codify what has been a definition that has been legally vetted in the Supreme Court. And that definition would be pretty, you know, stringent in that it, and I don't know it from memory, but it would essentially require of an alleged victim to prove that they had endured, you know, pervasive harassment, severe harassment.
Pervasive and severe. I've seen people focus.
Severe, right?
Yeah, and I've seen people focus on those two adghetives a lot. Not just sexual harassment. It has to be pervasive and severe.
Yes.
What's the upshot there?
That's a tough question. I guess that would depend on who you asked, right? I mean, pervasive and severe, the concern about that is it's very subjective. And what, you know, constitutes pervasive and severe? Does it mean it has to happen multiple times? Does it mean that there are degrees of harm that a school will be able to pinpoint to to determine whether or not they will address it at all. I mean, that is the concern about the definition. Again, it is codified in law.
We got this message from the 1A Text Club. I'm a retired Title IX compliance officer, and yes, changes under DeVos make that work unbelievably harder. We had just begun to make headway in helping students feel safe and come forward with their experiences of sexual harassment, and had made some progress in making faculty and staff and other students understand that they are accountable for their actions. Now things are back where we started. There's one educator, a retired educator, Andrew, who sees these changes as a step backward. And I think a lot of people perceived Betsy DeVos as wanting to, if not slow the enforcement of sexual harassment and gender discrimination rules, at least to the extent the federal government can enforce them, if not reverse it, slow it down.
Well, I think from DeVos's perspective here, what she wanted to do was add more protections for accused students. That was really what she was concerned about when she undertook this process. On the other hand, from the perspective of critics, the bottom line here is this proposed rule is going to make it much harder for victims of sexual harassment, whether it's sexual assault or harassment, to get their school to investigate and adjudicate their claims because of multiple changes in the rule. One of those would say that colleges are only obligated to investigate misconduct that happens either on campus or within campus-sponsored activities. Another would say that complainants have to submit reports through a formal process. That's adding up, her critics say, to a picture where it's going to be tougher for victims to get relief.
Christine writes to us on Facebook, I've noticed that for-profit colleges have started advertising on TV again. This is the Phoenix Universities and the DeVries, I suppose. It concerns me a lot. Were laws rolled back to make these types of schools viable again? And Erica, I want to touch on this because during the Obama years, the Department of Education had a pretty draconian crackdown on for-profits. It wasn't just Democrats. John McCain, former senator, deceased now, Republican senator, was a huge critic, I think, of some for-profit colleges, if I remember correctly. The opposite seems to be happening now, that the shackles are gone.
Well, yes. So under the Obama administration, the Department of Ed definitely was shocked into action by some of the activity that they were seeing in the for-profit sector, and put forth very aggressive rules to hold for-profit schools accountable for their outcomes. Under Betsy DeVos, this administration believes that those schools have had a target on their back, and that they are being held accountable for outcomes that everyone should be held accountable to.
It should be said that part of the enforcement here was that a lot of these schools use a lot of money from federal programs like the GI Bill, a lot of soldiers
Absolutely.
Coming back from war, and they use our money in those schools.
Right. And I mean, just from students across the country, career changers, I mean, you know, they do receive a significant amount of financial aid funds. Or in federal funds in general. So, the for-profit industry has definitely breathed a sigh of relief under DeVos. They do believe that they are not, you know, there is not an administration looking to put them out of business. There are great concerns that some of the warnings that they were heeding and how they operated, they're completely free of them.
So what's been the primary effect here? Just that the government has backed off and it's business as usual?
I mean, what DeVos is doing, she's opened up for negotiation, should I say, two rules that they were very concerned about. The borrow defense rule, which allowed students to recoup losses, and the gainful employment rule that would have, held schools accountable for their debt to earnings ratios.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Erica Green, who covers education for the New York Times. Andrew Craigbaum is here as well, federal policy reporter at Inside Higher Ed. Coming up, the GOP-controlled House Committee on Education and Labor was in operation for many, many years under the GOP. That has now changed. We talked to the committee's new chairman. He's coming up after this. We're back in a minute. Stay close. Welcome back to 1A. It's Todd Zwillick. Before we get back to our conversation on Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education, I'd love your help with tomorrow's show. Virginia Senator Mark Warner will join us to talk about the Trump campaign, the leadership scandals in his home state, and he'll take your questions as well. Senator Warner recently said there is a ton of evidence to suggest that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia, and he's the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. So what do you want to ask Mark Warner? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Do you have a question for Virginia Senator Mark Warner? Share it with us, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. We'll put some of your questions to Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. That's tomorrow on 1A. Well, back to our discussion on Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. I want to bring in Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott, who represents Virginia's 3rd congressional district. That's the Hampton Roads region of Southern Virginia, Tidewater. He's the current chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor, newly named chairman in this new era of Democratic control. Mr. Chairman, thanks for being on 1A. Hey,
Todd, it's good to be with you.
It's good to have you as well. The tax credit program we spent some time on, Mr. Chairman, I asked Jim Blue if it was dead in the water. He didn't seem to think so. He thought that they could get some support for this from Democrats in Congress. I suppose the football goes to you.
Well, we'll consider whatever they propose. One of the problems is we haven't seen many details. They call it a $5 billion program. I don't see how you can limit it to $5 billion if on April 15th people file their taxes and claim $50 billion worth of tax credits. I don't know how you deny people their tax credit. We'll see how that works. But the fact is that it's 100% tax credit, so that you can, instead, whatever your taxes are, you can decide to write a check to the scholarship program and just not pay taxes. So there is a significant diminution in revenue. And if you're going to spend that kind of money, it seems to me it's better spent in education on Pell Grants or Title I or Head Start or other things that will actually improve education. He mentioned that school choice is popular. Well, the rhetoric is popular, where you can go to any school you want to, public, private, or parochial school that you want to. But the fact is that 95% of the students are going to end up in public school. And if you've taken money away from public schools, then they'll have a rougher situation where they are.
So taking the administration's part here for a moment, Mr. Chairman, they would say this does not take money away from public schools because it's private money going to private people. But your point, as I take it, is that tax credit has to be paid for and that money is going to come out of school somehow.
Well, it's money that when you have a 100% tax credit, every dollar that's given is a dollar less coming in revenue. If you're going to spend money in education, there are better ways of spending it than in a scholarship program that's totally undefined.
I want to get to the bottom line. Are you devoted to killing this, or are you still in learn more phase?
Well, you know, you have to consider any proposal that's made, but I think it's fair to say that I'm skeptical.
Skeptical. You're now chairman of this committee that gives you oversight power over the Department of Education. There are a lot of areas of a lot of concern from advocates, educators, students, as you know, union members, teachers across the board. And you are taking control of a portfolio that has been very controversial for many, many years, Mr. Chairman. Give me a sense of your roadmap for oversight for the Department of Education now.
Well, first of all, I think you have to point out that focusing on education and issues before the committee, that focus is going to be difficult. In the last 2 days last week, we reported legislation on a school construction bill, a gender discrimination bill, We had hearings on school discipline, workplace safety. I had budget briefings and a hearing on the 2017 tax cut, multiple other meetings. And all the media reported to my constituents was that Michael Cohen was testifying in Congress. And that's all the media is interested in. Focusing on education is obviously going to be a challenge. But there are a lot of oversight issues, one of which we have K through 12, where Every Student Succeeds Act was passed a couple of years ago, which gave flexibility to local and state government. But there's no flexibility on the requirement to ascertain whether or not there are achievement gaps. And if so, what are you doing? You have to have a credible plan to eliminate them. We have concerns that the Department of Education is in the process of approving plans that are not nearly aggressive enough to comply with the spirit of that law. We have civil rights concerns with the administration. One of the first things they did, in spite of a GAO report that showed that our schools are becoming more and more racially segregated, the first thing they did was to eliminate a program that helped localities integrate their schools. Now, that's a little complicated because the Supreme Court has put roadblocks in front of some voluntary school integration plans, but it can be done. You just have to do it correctly, and there was guidance, and they eliminated a program that helped them do that.
What have your discussions with the administration been like since you took over as chairman? Would you describe this as a work-together, collegial type of relationship? Is there a relationship? You get your phone calls answered. Can you talk to the chief of staff? How's it working?
Well, we've, in the past several years, past 2 years of the administration, we've asked a lot of questions in my capacity of ranking member.
But you're the boss
Democrat
now.
And I believe that, you know, I remember one report that said that administration officials were directed not to bother to answer questions unless they came, quote, from the committee. Well, from the committee means the majority. And so, frankly, we didn't get a lot of answers to questions that we'd posed.
What about now?
Well, we've asked a lot of questions. We've just begun, for month of January was organization, and month of February we've begun asking questions, and some have been not as complete as we'd like, and we're going to follow through.
We spent a little time before you sat down, Mr. Chairman, on the issue of Title IX and enforcement of gender discrimination and sexual harassment rules at institutions that receive public money. We're waiting on the administration's final rules. As Andrew mentioned, over 100,000 comments. I know the media is covering Michael Cohen, but people out there are extremely interested in this issue. What's your posture now? You're waiting on rules to come out as well, and then what?
Well, there's several issues in the draft rule. One is the changing the burden of proof from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing, which is a much more difficult burden to carry. You can win a civil lawsuit with preponderance of evidence, and increasing the standard to clear and convincing would just make it more difficult for victims to prove their case. Who you report to, and who's responsible? I mean, you could have a campus where there is a widespread understanding and reputation that things are going wrong. Unless someone is in a position to have gotten a written report, there's no obligation for anybody to do anything. I think if people are aware of a problem, they ought to have to act. And then I think, as was mentioned, where the offense occurred, they have limited it, I think, unnecessarily to on-campus or campus events. There are a lot of students live off-campus, and problems occur right close to the campus, but not technically on the campus, and I think those ought to be part of it. So there are a lot of little details that have to be worked out. It's a complicated issue, and they got 100,000 comments. And I think as they consider the comments, hopefully they'll improve their draft.
And since you've come on the air, Mr. Chairman, people are right back on this issue of tax credits and school vouchers. Gann tweets, I think Betsy DeVos doesn't understand about education that it benefits the public. Therefore, it should be owned by the public. Vouchers and for-profit schools fly in the face of that idea. And Rachel writes, the issue of accountability and transparency. I have no problem with taxes supporting education in many forms. A better educated population benefits us all. But if schools take public money in the form of vouchers or tax credits, they should be subject to the same reporting and performance standards as publicly funded local and charter schools.
One of the problems with the proposal is that there are no details to it. What oversight there is for a school that receives money through this program is I haven't seen any details on that. It's hard to respond, but the fact is that money will be diverted from the federal revenues into this program. And if you're going to spend that kind of money, it ought to be spent on something that we know will help the public education.
So, Mr. Chairman, what about the overall state of not only education policy legislation in Congress, but oversight? You've got a Republican-controlled Senate, Democratic-controlled House. I could be wrong, but I don't see any Bobby Scott bill on education that President Trump would probably sign. Does that mean we're in a holding pattern, at least for the next 2 years, of DOE policies that you can criticize and do oversight on, but no significant legislation?
Well, there is a value to oversight. One of the problems with you mentioned for-profit education and the higher education, a lot of the for-profit schools are problematic. Many of them are closing abruptly, leaving students in a lurch. There is a program called Borrower's Defense. If you're at a school that abruptly closes, you have the right not to pay the student loan. The process for getting Borrower's Defense has been subject to attack by this administration. They've been undermining your ability to get Borrower's Defense. And we've asked a lot of questions, and I think the questions themselves have modified the stance and I think improved students' ability to get Borrower's Defense, but there's still over 100,000 students waiting in line to get consideration. There are other higher education issues but we'd need to make sure that just asking the question many times can get results.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. The power of oversight, Mr. Chairman, that you talk about and the role of oversight, that does seem like where we're at for the next 2 years. I ask it in this spirit. Have there been any substantive discussions between you and Betsy DeVos or anyone else in a position to sponsor or approve of legislation in the Trump administration to suggest there may be any in the next 2 years?
Well, in terms of oversight, we asked there's an accreditor, ACICS, that has been problematic, and we've asked questions about that. And I think
now, what is that? An accreditor of
The for-profit, basically the for-profit sector. They have historically accredited schools that are problematic, and you can't participate in the student loan and Pell Grant program unless you have accreditation. They've accredited schools that shouldn't have been accredited, and we've asked questions about it. And I think we've seen some results. But we're in the process of trying to reauthorize the Higher Education Act. That's Pell Grant, student loans, Title IX, and we believe that we can do a comprehensive reauthorization. We already have, on a bipartisan basis, established five hearings in the coming weeks on cost of college, access and quality, things like that, to make sure that young people can have access to a quality education.
So you believe that the old bipartisanship on No Child Left Behind and the other big education bills that have passed over the last decade, you think it still exists?
Well, we're going to try to reauthorize a comprehensive Higher Education Act to make it easier for students to get a decent education, including skills education, to make sure that young people, if they're not going to a four-year on-campus undergraduate liberal arts college, can get skills education and welding and other things. And we ought to see if we can't get federal support so that people can get those opportunities as well as a four-year college. We've started off on a bipartisan basis, and we'll just see. We were able to do it on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind in the form of the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. We were successful in that, and we're going to try it in higher education.
That's Chairman Bobby Scott, Democrat of Virginia, Chairman of the Education and Labor Committee in the House. Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate you stopping by.
Good, thank you.
We've been hearing from so many of you as we come to the end of the hour here. Boots tweets, whatever happened to the idea of the greater good in public education? When we lift up our neighbors, we lift up our community, and by association, ourselves. And Mary points out that Arne Duncan and Margaret Spelling, both former education secretaries, also went to private schools as children. She says, honestly, why does it matter? People can choose to send their kids to private schools. It's not a sin. They pay for it, and they pay for the public schools as well. Erica, I want to give you the last word here, a tiny bit of analysis. I put this question to the chairman a couple of times. Democratic-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate. The chairman seems to think he has a shot at bipartisan reauthorization of some major education legislation. A chance for some real legislating between the Trump administration and Democrats?
On higher education, I think so. It seems that both sides of the aisle want to get this done. They have very powerful champions. We have Senator Lamar Alexander, who was in his last term. He and his allies have on the Democratic side, which includes Mr. Scott, they have a history of getting legislation done. They did so with the K-12 law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and I actually think there is some hope there.
Andrew, you agree quickly that whatever animosity there is among many Democrats and liberals about Betsy DeVos, it might be put aside for some actual legislation here?
Yeah, well, it's really, I think, Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray in the Senate are really going to be driving this discussion. And like Erica said, Alexander's in his last term. He's been very devoted to higher ed issues, and I think he's motivated to get this done. So the chances are probably better than they've been in recent years.
Something to keep our eyes on as we continue to follow education policy from here in Washington. One show that is covering education policy, despite high-profile hearings, the Trump investigation, and Michael Cohen, an issue I know that Bobby Scott is happy to know about, that this show and its listeners are still devoted to this issue and take it extremely seriously. I want to thank all of you for being my guests. Erica Green, who covers education policy at the New York Times. Erica, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Krabom is a reporter covering federal policy for Inside Higher Ed. Andrew, thanks to you.
Great to be here.
You also heard from Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor. Remember to send us your stories about the topics you hear on this show. 855-236-1A1A is the number to call when you participate in our show. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. This is 1A.